drew the outline of a large flower, like a child's drawing, in the earth. "Voila," he said, "a flower in February, in spite of the appalling English weather." "Poirot, you've got mud on your finger." "Oui. Why do you sound surprised?" "Even the famous Hercule Poirot cannot create a flower in mud while keeping his hand clean." "It will come off, the dirt. Do not fear. There is always the manicure later." "Of course there is," I smiled. "I'm glad to hear you so sanguine on the subject." Poirot had produced a handkerchief. I watched in fascination as he used it to wipe the footprints from the gravestone, huffing and puffing as he rocked back and forth, nearly losing his balance once or twice. "There," he declared. "Simio." "Yes, better." Poirot frowned down at his feet. "There are sights so dispiriting that one wishes one did not have to see them," he said quietly. "We must trust that Patrick and Francis Ive rest in peace together." It was the word "together" that did it. It brought to mind another word, "apart." My face must have been a picture. "Catchpole, something is the matter with you. What is it?" "Together, apart." Patrick Ive was in love with Nancy Duquesne. But in death, in their shared grave, he was with the woman to whom he had rightfully belonged in life, his wife Frances. Had this soul found peace? Or was it pining for Nancy? Did Nancy ask herself this? Did she wish, loving Patrick as she did, that the dead could speak to the living? Anyone who had loved and lost someone precious to them might wish that. "Catchpole, what is in your mind at this moment? I must know." "Poirot, I've had the most preposterous idea. Let me tell you quickly so that you can tell me I am crazy." I babbled excitedly until he had heard the whole of it. "I'm wrong, of course," I concluded.
"Oh, no, 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 no. No, mon ami, you are not wrong," he gasped. "Of course. How did I fail to see it? Mon Dieu! Do you see what this means? What we must now conclude?"
"No, I'm afraid I don't."
"Ah, dommage."
"For pity's sake, Poirot, it's hardly fair to make me lay out my idea and then withhold yours." "There is no time for discussion now. We must hurry back to London, where you will pack up the clothes and personal effects of Harriet Zippel and Ida Gronsberry." "What?" I frowned in confusion, wondering if my ears were deceiving me. "Oui, Mr. Negus has already had his belongings removed by his brother, if you recall." "I do, but—" "Do not argue, Catchpole. It will take you hardly any time to pack two ladies' cases with the clothes in their hotel rooms."
"Now I see it. I see all of it at last. All the solutions to the many little puzzles they are in place.
You know, it is rather like the crossword puzzle." "Please don't make the comparison," I said. "You're likely to put me off my favourite pastime if you compare it to this case."
"Only when one sees all of the answers together does one know for certain that one is right,"
Poirot went on, ignoring me.
"Until then, for as long as some answers are missing, one may yet discover that a detail that seems to fit, in fact, does not fit at all."
"In that case, think of me as an empty crossword grid with no words filled in," I said.
"Not for long, my friend, not for long. Poirot, you will require the dining room of the Bloxham Hotel one last time."
Chapter 22. The Monogram Murders. The following afternoon, at 4:15, Poirot and I stood at one end of the Bloxham Hotel's dining room and waited
as people took their places at the various tables.
The hotel staff had all arrived promptly at 4 o'clock, as Luca Lazzari had promised they would. I smiled at the familiar faces. John Good, Thomas Brignall, Raphael Bobak. They acknowledged me with nervous nods. Lazzari was standing by the door, throwing his arms around in wild gesticulation as he spoke to Constable Stanley Beer. Beer kept having to duck and step back in order to avoid being clonked in the face. I was too far away to catch most of what Lazzari was saying, and the room was too noisy. But I did hear these monogram murders more than once. Was that what Lazzari had decided to call them? Everybody else in the country was calling them by the name the newspapers had chosen from the first day, the Bloxham Hotel murders. Evidently, Lazzari had come up with a more imaginative alternative, in the hope that his beloved establishment would not be forever tarnished by association. I found this so transparent as to be irritating. But I knew that my mood was coloured by my failure on the suitcase packing front. I am easily capable of packing for myself before a trip, but that is because I take as little as possible when I travel. Ida Gransbury's clothes must have expanded during her short stay at the Bloxham. I had spent an infuriating while pressing and leaning down with my full weight, and still I could not fit many of her clothes in her case. No doubt there is a feminine knack to these things that oafish men like me will never master. I was exceedingly relieved to be told by Poirot that I must stop trying and make my way to the hotel's dining room at the appointed hour of 4 o'clock. Samuel Kidd, in a smart grey flannel suit, had arrived with a pale-faced Jenny Hobbs on his arm at 4:05, followed 2 minutes later by Henry Negus, Richard's brother, and 10 minutes after that by a group of four, a man and 3 women, one of whom was Nancy Duquesne. The skin around her tear-filled eyes was red raw. As she entered the room, she tried unsuccessfully to conceal her face behind a scarf made of diaphanous material. I muttered to Poirot, "She doesn't want people to see that she has been crying." "Non," he said. "She wears the scarf because she hopes not to be recognized, not because she is ashamed of her tears. There is nothing reprehensible in allowing a feeling to show outwardly, contrary to what you Englishmen seem to believe." I had no wish to be diverted to the topic of myself when I had been talking about Nancy Duquesne, in whom I was far more interested. I suppose the last thing she wants is to be set upon by eager fans, all falling in an adoring heap at her faraway feet. Poirot, as a somewhat famous person himself, who should have liked nothing better than a pile of admirers draped all over his spats, looked as if he was about to take issue with this point as well. I distracted him with a question. "Who are the 3 people who came in with Nancy Duquesne?"
"Lord St. John Wallace, Lady Louisa Wallace, and their servant Dorcas."
He looked at his watch and tutted.
"We are 15 minutes late in starting. Why cannot people arrive on time?"
I noticed that both Thomas Brignall and Raphael Bobak had risen to their feet, both apparently wanting to speak, although the proceedings were not yet officially underway.
"Please, gentlemen, sit down," Poirot said. "But, Mr. Poirot, sir, I must—"
"But I—" "Do not agitate yourselves, messieurs. These things that you are so determined to tell Poirot, you may be assured that he knows them already, and that he is about to tell you and everybody gathered here those very same things. Be patient, I beg of you."
Mollified, Bobak and Brignall sat down. I was surprised to see the black-haired woman sitting next to Brignall reach for his hand. He squeezed hers, and they allowed their hands to remain entwined. I saw the look that passed between them, and it told me all I needed to know. They were sweethearts. This, however, was definitely not the woman I had seen Brignall canoodling with in the hotel gardens. Poirot whispered in my ear,
"The woman Brignall was kissing in the garden, beside the wheelbarrow. She had fair hair, no? The woman with the brown coat?" He gave me an enigmatic smile.
To the crowd, he said, "Now that everyone has arrived, please may I ask for silence and your full attention. Thank you. I am obliged to you all."
As Poirot spoke, I cast my eyes over the faces in the room.
Was that... Oh, my goodness. It was.
Fee Spring, the waitress from Pleasance, was sitting at the back of the room. Like Nancy Duquesne, she had made an effort to cover her face with a fancy sort of hat, and like Nancy, she had failed. She winked at me as if to say that it served me and Poirot right for stopping in for a drink and telling her where we were going next. Confound it all. Why couldn't the little minx stay in the coffee-house where she belonged?
"I must ask for your forbearance today," said Poirot. "There is much that you need to know and understand that you do not at present."
Yes, I thought. That summed up my position perfectly. I knew scarcely more than the Bloxhams' chambermaids and cooks did. Perhaps even Fee Spring had a stronger grasp on the facts than I. Poirot had probably invited her to this grand event he had arranged. I must say, I did not and never would understand why he required such a sizable audience. It was not a theatrical production. When I solved a crime, and I had been lucky enough to do so several times without Poirot's help, I simply presented my conclusions to my boss and then arrested the miscreant in question. I wondered, too late, if I ought to have demanded that Poirot tell me everything first, before staging this spectacle. Here I was, supposedly in charge of the investigation, and I had no inkling of what solution to the mystery he was about to present. "Whatever he is about to say, please let it be brilliant," I prayed. "If he gets it right, and I am standing by his side, no one will suspect that I was once, and so late in the day, as unenlightened as I am now."
"The story is too long for me to tell it without help," Poirot addressed the room. "My voice, I would wear it out. Therefore, I must ask you to listen to two other speakers. First, Mrs. Nancy Duquesne, the famous portrait painter who has done us the honor of joining us here today, will speak."
This was a surprise, though not to Nancy herself, I noticed. From her face, it was apparent that she had known Poirot would call upon her. The two of them had arranged it in advance. Awed whispers filled the room as Nancy, with her scarf wrapped round her face, came to stand beside me where everyone could see her.
"You've blown her cover with the adoring fans," I whispered to Poirot.
"Oui," he smiled.
"Yet she still keeps the scarf around her face as she speaks."
Everyone listened, rapt, as Nancy Duquesne told the story of Patrick Ive. Her forbidden love for him, her illicit visits to the vicarage at night, the wicked lies about him taking money from parishioners and, in exchange, passing on communications from their dead loved ones. She did not mention Jenny Hobbs by name when she referred to the rumour that had started all the trouble. Nancy described how she finally spoke out at the King's Head Inn and told the villagers of Great Holling about her love affair with Patrick Ive, which was not chaste, though she had pretended at the time that it was. Her voice shook as she told of the tragic deaths by poisoning of Patrick and Francis Ive. I noted that that was all she said about the cause of death. Poisoning. She did not specify accident or suicide. I wondered if Poirot had asked her not to, for the sake of Ambrose Flowerday and Margaret Ernst. Before sitting down, Nancy said, "I am as devoted to Patrick now as I ever was. I will never stop loving him. One day, he and I will be reunited."
"Thank you, Madame Duquesne." Poirot bowed.
"I must now, without delay, tell you something that I have recently discovered, for I believe it will be a comfort to you. Before his death, Patrick wrote
a letter. In it he asked for you to be told that he loved you and always would.
Oh.
Nancy clapped her hands over her mouth and blinked many times.
Monsieur Poirot, you cannot imagine how happy you have made me.
Au contraire, madame, I can imagine only too well. The loving message, conveyed after the death of the loved one. It is an echo, is it not, of the untrue rumours about Patrick Ive, that he conveyed messages from beyond the grave? And who, I ask you, would not wish to receive such a message from one they have loved very much and lost? Nancy Duquesne made her way back to her chair and sat down. Louisa Wallace patted her arm. "And now," said Poirot, "another woman who knew and loved Patrick Ive will speak. His former servant, Jenny Hobbs, Mademoiselle Hobbs." Jenny stood up and went to stand where Nancy had stood. She, too, looked unsurprised to be asked. In a shaking voice, she said,
"I loved Patrick Ive as much as Nancy did, but he did not reciprocate my love. To him I was no more than a loyal servant. It was I who started the wicked rumours about him. I told an unforgivable lie. I was jealous because he loved Nancy and not me. Although I did not kill him with my own hands, I believe that in slandering him as I did, I caused his death. I and three others, Harriet Sipple, Richard Negus, and Ida Gransbury, the three people who were murdered at this hotel. All four of us later came to regret what we had done. We regretted it profoundly, and so we made a plan to put things right."
I watched the astonished faces of the Bloxham Hotel staff as Jenny described the same plan that she had described to Poirot and me at Samuel Kidd's house, as well as how and why it went wrong. Louisa Wallace squealed in horror at the part about framing Nancy Duquesne for the three murders and making sure she hanged.
"Arranging for an innocent woman to be put to death for three murders she didn't commit is not righting a wrong,"
St. John Wallace called out.
"That is depravity."
Nobody disagreed with him, at least not out loud. Fee Spring, I noticed, did not look as shocked as most people did. She seemed to be listening intently.
"I never wanted to frame Nancy," said Jenny. "Never. You may believe that or not, as you wish."
"Mr. Negus," said Poirot.
"Mr. Henry Negus, do you think it likely that your brother, Richard, would make such a plan as you have heard?" Henry Negus stood up.
"I would not like to say, Monsieur Poirot. The Richard I knew would not have dreamt of killing anyone, of course. But the Richard who came to live with me in Devon 16 years ago was not the Richard I knew. Oh, the physicality of him was the same, but he was not the same man on the inside. I'm afraid to say that I never got to know the man that he had become. I cannot, therefore, comment on how likely he was to behave in a particular way."
"Thank you, Mr. Negus, and thank you, Miss Hobbs," Poirot added with a marked absence of enthusiasm. "You may now sit down."
He turned to the crowd.
"So you see, ladies and gentlemen, that Miss Hobbs's story, if true, leaves us with no murderer to arrest and convict. Ida Gransbury killed Harriet Sipple with her permission. Richard Negus killed Ida Gransbury again with her permission, and then killed himself when Jenny Hobbs did not arrive to kill him as she was supposed to. He took his own life, and made it look like murder
by first locking his door and hiding the key behind a loose tile in the fireplace, and then opening the window.
The police were supposed to think that the murderer, Nancy Duquesne, took the key with her and escaped through the open window and down a tree. But there was no murderer, according to Jenny Obbs. Nobody who killed without permission of the victim.
Poirot looked around the room.
No murderer, he repeated. However, even if this were true, there would still be two criminals who are alive and deserving of punishment. Jenny Hobbs and Samuel Kidd, who conspired to frame Nancy Duquesne.
I hope you're going to lock them both up, Monsieur Poirot,
called out Louisa Wallace.
I do not lock or unlock the prison gate, madame. That is the job of my friend Catchpool and his associates. I unlock only the secrets and the truth. Mr. Samuel Kidd, please stand.
Kidd, looking uncomfortable, rose to his feet.
Your part in the plan was to place a note on the front desk of this hotel, was it not? May they never rest in peace, 121-238-317.
Yes, sir. It was, like Jenny said.
You had been given the note by Jenny in good time to do this.
Yeah. Yeah, she gave it to me earlier in the day, in the morning.
And you were to put it on the desk when?
Shortly after 8 o'clock in the evening, like Jenny said. As soon as I could after 8, but first making sure no one was close enough to see me put it there.
You had this instruction from whom?
Poirot asked.
Jenny.
And also from Jenny, you had the instruction to plant the room keys in the pocket of Nancy Duquesne.
That's right, said Kidd in a sullen voice. I don't know why you're asking me all this when she's only just now finished telling you.
I will explain. Bon. According to the original plan, as we have all heard Jenny Hobbs say, the keys to all three rooms, 121, 238, and 317, would be removed from Richard Negus's room by Jenny after she had killed him, and given to Samuel Kidd, who would place them somewhere that would implicate Nancy Duquesne, her coat pocket, as it turned out. But Jenny Hobbs did not go to the Bloxham Hotel at all on the night of the murders, according to her story. She was not brave enough. I therefore ask you, Mr. Kidd, how did you get hold of the keys to rooms 121 and 317?
How did I get hold of the two keys?
Yes. That is the question I asked you. Please answer it.
Well, if you must know, I got hold of those keys thanks to my own wits. I had a word in the ear of a member of the hotel staff and asked if they'd be good enough to let me have a master key, and they did, and I returned it to them once I'd used it, all discreet-like.
I was standing close enough to Poirot to hear the noise of disapproval that he made.
Which member of staff, monsieur? They are all here in this room. Point to the person who gave you this master key.
I can't remember who it was. A man, that's all I can tell you. I've a pitiful memory for faces.
As he said this, Kidd rubbed the red scratches on his own face with his thumb and forefinger.
So with this master key, you let yourself into all three rooms?
No, only room 238. That's where all the keys ought to have ended up, waiting for Jenny to take them. But I could only find two. As you've said, one was hidden behind a tile in the fireplace.
I didn't like to stay and search the room for the third key, what with Mr. Negus's body being there and all.
You are lying,
Poirot told him.
"It does not matter. You will discover in due course that you cannot lie your way out of this predicament. But let us move on.
No, do not sit down. I have another question.
For you and Jenny Hobbs. It was part of the plan, was it not, that Jenny should bring her tale of mortal fear to me at Pleasance Coffee House at just after 7:30 on the night of the murders?
Yes, said Jenny, looking not at Poirot but at Samuel Kidd.
Forgive me, then, but I do not understand something important. You are too afraid to go through with the plan, you say, and so you did not arrive at the hotel at 6 o'clock. Yet, the plan went ahead without you, it seems. The only deviation was that Richard Negus killed himself, yes? He put the poison into his own drink, rather than having it put in his drink by you. Is everything that I have said so far correct, mademoiselle?
Yes, it is.
In that case, if the only altered detail was Richard Negus killing himself instead of being killed, we can assume that the deaths took place as planned, after the ordering of the sandwiches and scones between 7:15 and 8 o'clock. Yes, Miss Hobbs?
That is right, said Jenny.
She did not sound quite as certain as she had a moment ago. Then how, I might ask, can it ever have been part of the plan for you to kill Richard Negus? You have told us that you intended to find me at Pleasance Coffee House shortly after 7:30 on that same night, knowing I would be there for my regular Thursday evening dinner. It is impossible to get from the Bloxham Hotel to Pleasance Coffee House in less than 30 minutes. It cannot be done, no matter how one travels. So, even if Ida Gransberry had killed Harriet Sipple and Richard Negus had killed Ida Gransberry as soon as was possible after 7:15, there would not have been time for you to kill Richard Negus in room 238 after that time and still arrive at Pleasance when you did. How are we supposed to believe that in all the meticulous planning that you undertook, none of you thought of this practical impossibility?
Jenny's face had turned white. I expect mine had too, though I could not see it myself. It was such an obvious flaw in her account that Poirot had pointed out, and yet I had failed to spot it.
It simply had not occurred to me.
Chapter 23. The Real Ida Gransberry.
Samuel Kidd chuckled, turning round so that more people could see him. He said,
"Mr. Poirot, for a man who takes pride in his powers of detection, you're not the sharpest of instruments, are you? I've heard Jenny talk about this more often than you have, I think I can safely say.
The plan was not for the killings to take place after 7:15. I don't know where you've caught hold of that idea. The plan was for them to happen just after 6 o'clock. The ordering of food at 7:15 wasn't part of it either."
"That's right," said Jenny. Offered a way out of the trap by her quick-thinking former fiancé, she appeared to have recovered her composure.
"I can only conclude that my failure to arrive at 6, as agreed, caused a delay. The others would have wanted to discuss my failure to present myself. I should have in their place. The discussion about what to do might have taken some time."
"Bien sûr. You did not correct me a few moments ago, however, when I asserted that the deaths took place as planned, between 7:15 and 8 o'clock. Neither did you say that the ordering of the very late afternoon tea was not part of the plan."
"I'm sorry, I should have corrected you," said Jenny. I mean, this is all rather overwhelming."
"You now say that the plan was for the three killings to take place at 6 o'clock?"
"Yes, and all be done by 7:15, so that I could get to Pleasance by 7:30.
"In that case,
I have a different question for you, mademoiselle. Why did the plan require Mr. Kidd to wait a full hour, once Harriet, Ida, and Richard were all dead, and once you had left the hotel, before placing the note on the front desk? Why was it not agreed that Mr. Kidd should do this at, for example, a 7:15, or even 7:30? Why 8 o'clock?
Jenny recoiled as if from a blow.
"Why not 8 o'clock?" she said defiantly. "What was the harm in waiting a while?"
"You ask some daft questions, Mr. Poirot," said Sam Kidd.
"No harm whatever in waiting, mademoiselle. I agree entirely. Therefore, we must ask ourselves, why leave a note at all? Why not wait for the hotel maids to find the 3 bodies the following morning? Jenny, do not look at Samuel Kidd. Look at Hercule Poirot. Answer the question."
I don't know. I think maybe Richard..."
"No, not maybe Richard."
Poirot spoke over her. "If you will not answer my question, allow me to do so. You told Mr. Kidd to leave the note on the desk just after 8, because it was always part of the plan for the murders to appear to have been committed between 7:15 and 8 o'clock.
Poirot turned once again to the silent, wide-eyed crowd. "Let us think about the afternoon tea for 3 that was ordered and delivered to room 317, Ida Gronsberry's room. Let us imagine that our 3 voluntary victims, puzzled by the absence of Jenny Hobbs, were unsure what to do, and so went to Ida Gronsberry's room to discuss the matter. Catchpool, if you are about to allow yourself to be executed for a past sin, would you order scones and cakes immediately beforehand?"
"No, I would be too nervous to eat or drink anything."
"Perhaps our trio of executioners thought it important to keep up their strength for the important task ahead," Poirot speculated. "Then, when the food arrived, they could not bring themselves to eat it. But to where did all this food disappear?"
"Are you asking me?"
said Jenny.
"I'm afraid I don't know, since I wasn't there."
"To return to the timing of these killings," said Poirot, "the police doctor's view was that death occurred in all 3 cases between 4 and 8:30. Circumstantial evidence later narrowed this down to between 7:15 and 8:10. Eh bien, let us examine that circumstantial evidence. The waiter, Raphael Bobac, saw all 3 victims alive at 7:15 when he made his delivery to room 317. And Thomas Brignall saw Richard Negus alive at 7:30 in the hotel lobby, when Negus complimented Brignall on his efficiency, asked him to make sure the tea and cakes were put on his bill, and requested a sherry. So it seems that none of the killings can have happened before 7:15, and that the murder of Richard Negus cannot have happened before 7:30. However, there are a handful of details that do not fit to make the neat picture. First, there is the disappearing food that we know was not eaten by Harriet Sipple, Ida Gronsberry, and Richard Negus. I do not believe that anyone about to kill for the first time would imagine he might first want to eat a scone. So why order food that one has no intention of eating, unless to establish in the eyes of a witness that you are alive at 7:15? And why should it be necessary for our 3 victims to be seen alive at that specific time? I can think of just one possible explanation that is consistent with Jenny Hobbs' story.
If our conspirators knew, somehow,
that Nancy Duquesne had no credible alibi for the hour between 7:15 and 7:15, they might have wished to make it look as if that was when the killings took place. But Nancy Duquesne has a very solid alibi for that hour, does she not, Lady Wallace?
Louisa Wallace rose to her feet.
Yes, she does. She was with me and my husband until around 10 o'clock that evening, dining in our home.
Merci beaucoup, madame.
Alors,
I can think of only one reason why it should be of such vital importance to create the appearance of the three deaths having taken place between 7:15 and 8:10.
Between those times, Jenny Hobbs has an unshakable alibi.
I, Hercule Poirot, know perfectly well that she cannot have been at the Bloxham Hotel then. She was with me at Pleasance Coffee House between 7:35 and 7:50.
And I have already spoken about the travelling times involved.
I put all this together with my conviction that the three deaths did not occur between 7:15 and 8:10, and I begin to wonder. Why go to such trouble to make it look as if Jenny Hobbs could not have committed these murders unless, in fact, she did commit them?
Jenny leapt up out of her chair.
I didn't kill anybody. I swear I didn't. Of course they died between 7:15 and 8:00. It's clear to everybody but you.
Sit down and remain silent, Miss Hobbs, unless I ask you a direct question, said Poirot coldly.
Samuel Kidd's face was contorted with rage.
You're making all this up, Mr. Poirot. How do you know they didn't order that food because they were ravenous hungry? Just because you wouldn't be or I wouldn't be doesn't mean they weren't.
Then why did they not eat the food, Mr. Kidd? I asked. Where did all those sandwiches and cakes vanish to?
The finest afternoon tea in all of London, murmured Luca Lazzari.
I will tell you where it went, Catchpool, said Poirot.
Our murderer made a mistake relating to the afternoon tea, one of many. If the food had been left on the plates in room 317 for the police to find, there would have been no mystery. It would have been assumed that the killer arrived and interrupted the happy occasion before the feast could begin. But the killer thinks it will arouse suspicion, all that uneaten food. He does not want anyone to ask the question, why order food and then not eat it?
Then what became of the food? I asked. Where did it disappear to?
The conspirators removed it from the scene.
Oh, yes, ladies and gentlemen, there was most assuredly a conspiracy to commit these three murders.
In case I have not yet made it clear, Harriet Sipple, Ida Gransbury, and Richard Negus were all dead long before 7:15 on the Thursday in question.
Luca Lazzari stepped forward.
Monsieur Poirot, please forgive my intrusion, but I must tell you that Raphael Bobac, my most loyal of waiters, would not lie. He saw the three murder victims alive and well when he delivered the food at 7:15, alive and well. You must be mistaken in what you are saying.
I am not mistaken, though in one respect you are correct. Your waiter, Raphael Bobac, is indeed an exemplary witness. He certainly saw three people in room 317 when he delivered the afternoon tea. But those people were not Harriet Sipple, Ida Gransbury, and Richard Negus.
All over the room there were gasps of shock. I gave one myself, racking my brains to think who else the three might have been. Not Jenny Hobbs, for she would have been on her way to Pleasance Coffee House at that time. Who then?
Poirot, I said nervously.
Is it your contention that three people impersonated the murder victims in order to make it look as if they were still alive when the food was delivered?
Not precisely, no. In fact, two people impersonated two of the murder victims. The third person, Ida Gransberry, she was not an impersonation, I am sorry to say. No, she was unfortunately the real Ida Gransberry. Mr. Bobak, do you remember what you told me about what you overheard and what you witnessed when you took the afternoon tea to room 317?
I recall every word, since you have given me your account twice.
Would you mind if I repeat it now for the benefit of us all?
No, sir, I would not.
Merci. You arrived to find the three murder victims apparently alive and talking about people they knew. You heard Harriet Sipple, or the woman later referred to as Harriet by the man in the room, say, "She had no choice, did she? She is no longer the one he confides in. He'd hardly be interested in her now. She's let herself go, and she's old enough to be his mother. No, if she wanted to find out what was going on in his mind, she had no choice but to receive the woman he does confide in and talk to her." This was when the man in the room broke off from attending to you and to the food, and said, "Oh, Harriet, that's hardly fair. Ida's easily shocked. Go easy on her." Have I been accurate so far, Mr. Bobak?
You have, sir.
You then told me that either Ida or Harriet said something else that you could not remember. And then the man you assumed was Richard Negus said, "His mind? I'd argue he has no mind. And I dispute the old enough to be his mother claim. I dispute it utterly." At which point the woman going by the name of Harriet laughed and said, "Well, neither of us can prove we're right. So let us agree to disagree." Correct. Raphael Bobak confirmed that, once again, Poirot had got it right.
Bon. May I suggest to you, Mr. Bobak, that the remark made by either Ida or Harriet that you do not remember was in fact made by Harriet? I am convinced, absolutely convinced, that you did not hear Ida Gransberry speak one single word while you were in that room, and that you did not see her face, because she was sitting with her back facing the door.
Bobak frowned, concentrating. Eventually he said,
"I think you are right, Mr. Poirot.
No, I did not see the face of Miss Ida Gransberry, and I don't think I heard her speak at all, now that you bring it up."
"You did not hear her speak, monsieur, for the simple reason that Ida Gransberry, propped up in a chair with her back facing the door, was already murdered by a 7:15, the third person in room 317 when you took up the afternoon tea, was a dead woman."
Chapter 24. The Blue Jug and Bowl.
A few people cried out in alarm. There is a strong chance that I was one of them. It is strange. I have seen many dead bodies, thanks to my work for Scotland Yard, and have on occasion found the sight of them disturbing. Yet no regular corpse could be as horrifying a prospect as a dead woman propped up as if alive and partaking of a jolly afternoon tea with friends. Poor Raphael Bobak looked rather shivery and wobbly-lipped, no doubt reflecting that he had been closer to the monstrosity than any sane person would wish to be. This is why the food had to be delivered to Ida Gransberry's room, Poirot went on.
Richard Negus's room 238 would have been the most convenient meeting point for the three victims, as it was on the second floor between the two other rooms. The afternoon tea would then have been added to Mr. Negus's bill without his having to make a point of requesting this. But of course, room 238 could not be the room in which our three murder victims were seen alive by Raphael Bobak at 7:15. That would have involved carrying Ida Gronsberry's dead body from her room 317, in which she had been killed some hours earlier, through the corridors of the hotel to Richard Negus's room. It would have been too great a risk. Someone would almost certainly have seen. The shocked faces of the bewildered crowd were something to behold. I wondered if Luca Lazzari would soon be seeking new staff. I definitely had no intention of returning to the Bloxham once this unpleasant business was concluded, and I imagined that many in the room felt the same way. Poirot proceeded with his explanations.
Reflect, ladies and gentlemen, upon the munificence, the largesse, of Mr. Richard Negus. Ah, how generous he was, insisting on paying for the food and the tea, also paying for Harriet and Ida each to travel alone to the hotel in a car. Why would they not come by train together and share a car to the hotel? And why should Richard Negus care so passionately about making sure that the bill for the food and beverages was sent to him, when he knew that he, Harriet Sipple, and Ida Gronsberry were all about to die? It was a very good question. All the points that Poirot was making were pertinent, and, moreover, were things I should have thought of myself. Somehow, I had failed to notice that so many aspects of Jenny Hobbs's story did not fit with the facts of the case. How could I have missed such glaring inconsistencies? Poirot said, "The man who impersonated Richard Negus at 7:15 for the benefit of Raphael Bobak, and again at 7:30 for the benefit of Mr. Thomas Brignell, did not care about any bill. He knew that neither he nor his accomplices would have to pay it. He had been outside to dispose of the food. How did he transport it? In a suitcase. Ketchpool, do you remember the tramp you saw near the hotel when we took our trip on a bus? A tramp eating food from a suitcase, no? You described him as the tramp that got the cream. Tell me, did you see him eating cream specifically? Oh, my goodness. Yes. Yes, I did. He was eating a cake with cream in it. Poirot nodded. From the suitcase he found discarded near the Bloxham Hotel, pleasingly full of afternoon tea for three. Now, here is another test for your memory, mon ami. Do you remember telling me, on my first visit to the Bloxham, that Ida Gronsberry had brought enough clothes with her to fill an entire wardrobe? And yet, she had only one suitcase in her room, the same number as Richard Negus and Harriet Sipple, who had brought considerably fewer clothes with them. This afternoon, I asked you to pack Miss Gronsberry's garments into her case, and what did you find? They wouldn't fit, I said, feeling like a prized chump. It seemed that I was doomed to feel idiotic in relation to Ida Gronsberry's suitcase, but now for a different reason from before. You blamed yourself, said Poirot. It is your preference to do so always, but in fact, it was impossible for all the clothes to fit in, because they had been brought to the Bloxham in two suitcases. Even Hercule Poirot, he could not have made them fit. To the assembled hotel staff, he said, "It was on his way back from disposing of the suitcase full of food that this man met the Bloxham's assistant clerk, Thomas Brignell, near the door to this room in which we are gathered.
Why did he engage Brignell in discussion about the bill?
For one reason only. To impress upon Brignell that Richard Negus was still alive at 7:30. Playing the role of Mr. Negus, he said something inaccurate. That Negus could afford to pay, whereas Ariette Sipel and Ida Gransberry could not.
This was not true. Henry Negus, Richard's brother, can confirm that Richard had no income and very little family money left. But the man impersonating Richard Negus did not know this. He assumed that since Richard Negus was a gentleman, once a lawyer by profession, he was bound to have plenty of money.
When Henry Negus first spoke to Catchpool and myself, he told us that since moving to Devon, his brother Richard had been morose and doom-laden. He was a recluse with no appetite for life. Correct, Mr. Negus?
Yes, I'm afraid so, said Henry Negus.
A recluse. I ask you, does this sound like a man who would indulge himself in sherry and cake and gossip in a cavalier fashion with two women in a fancy London hotel? No. The man who received the afternoon tea from Raphael Popak and for whom Thomas Brignell fetched the sherry was not Richard Negus. This man, he complimented Mr. Brignell on his efficiency and said something approximating the following. I know I can rely on you to sort this out since you are so efficient. Bill the food and beverages to me, Richard Negus, room 238.
His words were calculated to make Thomas Brignell believe that this man, this Richard Negus, was familiar with his level of efficiency, and that therefore they must have encountered one another before.
Mr. Brignell might feel a little guilty, perhaps, because he does not remember his previous dealings with Mr. Negus, and he will resolve not to forget him again. He will remember now on this man whom he has met twice.
Naturally, working in a large London hotel, he meets people all the time, hundreds every day. It often happens, I am sure, that guests know his name and face while he has forgotten theirs. After all, they are simply, en masse, the guests.
Excuse me, Monsieur Poirot, I beg your pardon.
Luca Lazzari hurried forward.
Broadly speaking, you are quite all right, but not as chance would have it in the case of Thomas Brignell. He has an exceptional memory for faces and names. Exceptional!
Poirot smiled appreciatively. Is that so?
Bon. Then I am right.
About what? I asked.
Be patient and listen, Catchpool. I will explain the sequence of events.
The man impersonating Richard Negus was in the lobby of the hotel when Mr. Negus checked in on Wednesday, the day before the murders. Probably he wanted to survey the territory in preparation for the role he was to play later. In any case, he saw Richard Negus arrive. How did he know it was Richard Negus? I will come back to that point. Suffice to say, he knew. He saw Thomas Brignell undertake the necessary paperwork and then hand Mr. Negus the key to his room. The following evening, after posing as Mr. Negus to receive the afternoon tea and then going outside to dispose of it, this man is on his way back to room 317 and he passes Thomas Brignell. He is a quick-thinking individual and he sees a superb opportunity to consolidate the misleading of the police. He approaches Brignell and addresses him as if he, this impostor, were Richard Negus. He reminds Brignell of his name and alludes to a previous meeting. In fact, Thomas Brignell has never met this man before, but he remembers the name from when he gave the real Richard Negus his room key. Here, Suddenly, is a man speaking to him in a confident, friendly, and knowledgeable fashion and calling himself by that same name. Thomas Brignell assumes that he must be Richard Negus. He does not recall his face, but he blames only himself for this lapse.
Thomas Brignell's face had turned as red as claret. Poirot went on.
The man impersonating Richard Negus asked for a glass of sherry. Why? To extend his encounter with Brignell a little, thereby imprinting it more strongly on the clerk's memory? To soothe agitated nerves with some liquor? Maybe for both of these reasons. Now, if you will permit me a small digression. In the remains of this glass of sherry, the poison cyanide was found, as it was in Harriet Sipple's and Ida Gransberry's cups of tea. But it was not the tea or the sherry that killed the three murder victims. It cannot have been. These beverages arrived too late to kill, long after the murders had been committed. The sherry glass and the two tea cups on the occasional tables next to the three bodies, they were essential for the staging of the crime scenes, to give the false impression that the killings must have occurred after 7:15. In fact, the cyanide that killed Harriet Sipple, Ida Gransberry, and Richard Negus was given to them much earlier and by another means. There is a water glass by the basin in each room of the hotel, is there not, Signor Lazari?
Si, Monsieur Poirot, yes, there is.
Then I expect that is how the poison was consumed, in water. The glass in each case was then carefully washed and replaced by the basin.
Mr. Brignell, Poirot addressed him unexpectedly, causing the assistant clerk to duck in his seat as if someone had taken a shot at him. You do not like to speak in public, but you plucked up the courage to do so the first time we all gathered in this room. You told us of your encounter with Mr. Negus in the corridor, but you did not mention the sherry, even though I had specifically asked about it. Later, you sought me out and added the detail about the sherry to your story. When I asked you why you did not originally mention it, you gave me no answer. I did not understand why. But my friend here, Catchpool, he said something most perceptive and illuminating. He said that you are a conscientious man who would only withhold information in a murder inquiry if it caused you great personal embarrassment and if you were sure it had nothing to do with the murder case. He hit upon the head of the nail with this assessment, did he not? Brignell gave a small nod.
Allow me to explain.
Poirot raised his voice, though it was quite loud enough in the first place.
When we met here in this room before, I asked if anybody had taken sherry to Mr. Negus in his room. No one spoke up. Why did Thomas Brignell not say, I did not take it up to his room, but I did fetch for him a glass of sherry. Poirot will tell you. He did not do so because he had doubts in his mind and he did not want to risk saying something that was not true. Mr. Brignell was the only member of the hotel staff to see any of the three murder victims more than once, or to be more precise, he had been led to believe that he had seen Richard Negus more than once. He knew that he had given a glass of sherry to a man calling himself Richard Negus, who behaved as if he had encountered him before. But this man did not look like the Richard Negus that Thomas Brignell had met. Remember, Mr. Lazari has told us that Mr. Brignell has an excellent memory for faces as well as names. That
is why he did not speak up when I asked about the sherry. He was distracted by his thoughts. A voice in his head whispered, "It must have been him, the same man, but it was not him. I would have recognized him."
A few moments later, Mr. Brignall said to himself,
"What kind of fool am I? Of course it was Richard Negus if he said that was his name. For once, my memory lets me down. And besides, the man sounded just like Mr. Negus with his educated English accent. It would seem incroyable to the scrupulously honest Thomas Brignall that anyone should wish to impersonate another in order to trick him."
After reaching the conclusion that the man must have been Richard Negus, Mr. Brignall decides to stand up and tell me that he met Mr. Negus in the corridor at 7:30 on the night of the murders. But he is too embarrassed to mention the sherry, because he fears he will seem an imbecile for sitting in silence in response to my earlier question about the drink. I would surely ask, in front of everybody, "Why did you not tell me this before?" And Mr. Brignall would have been mortified to have to say, "Because I was too busy wondering how Mr. Negus came to have a different face the second time I encountered him." Mr. Brignall, can you confirm that what I am saying is true? There is no need to worry about looking like a fool. You are the opposite. It was a different face. It was a different man."
"Thank goodness," said Brignall. "Everything you have said is absolutely correct, Mr. Poirot."
"Bien sûr," said Poirot immodestly.
"Do not forget, ladies and gentlemen, that the same name does not necessarily mean the same person. When Signor Lazari described to me the woman who took a room in this hotel using the name Jenny Hobbs, I thought that she was probably the same woman I had met at Pleasant's Coffee House. She sounded similar. Fair hair, dark brown hat, lighter brown coat. But two men who have each seen a woman fitting this description only once, they cannot be certain they have seen the same woman." This led me to ruminate. I already suspected that the dead Richard Negus, whose body I saw, and the living Richard Negus seen by Raphael Bobak and Thomas Brignall on the night of the murders, were two different men. Then I remembered being told that on arrival at the Bloxham on the Wednesday, Richard Negus was dealt with by Thomas Brignall. If I was right in my suppositions, then this would have been a different Richard Negus, the real one. Suddenly, I understood Thomas Brignall's predicament. How could he say publicly that this one man appeared to have two faces? Everyone would think him a lunatic.
"You're the one who sounds half crazed, Mr. Poirot," said Samuel Kidd with a sneer.
Poirot went on as if he hadn't spoken.
"This impostor might not have resembled Richard Negus in appearance, but I have no doubt that his voice was a perfect imitation. He is an excellent mimic. Are you not, Mr. Kidd?"
"Don't listen to this man, he's a liar."
"No, Mr. Kidd, it is you who are the liar. You have impersonated me more than once."
Fee Spring stood up at the back of the room.
"You should all believe Mr. Poirot," she said. "He's telling the truth, all right. I've heard Mr. Samuel Kidd speak in his accent. With my eyes closed, I not know the difference."
"It is not only with his voice that Samuel Kidd lies," said Poirot. "The first time I met him, he presented himself as a man of below-average intelligence and slovenly appearance. His shirt with the missing button and the stain, also the incomplete beard. He had shaved only one small patch of his face. Mr. Kidd, please tell everybody here
why you went to great lengths to make yourselves look so disheveled the first time we met?
Samuel Kidd stared resolutely ahead. He said nothing. His eyes were full of loathing.
Very well. If you will not speak, then I shall explain it myself. Mr. Kidd cut his cheek while climbing down the tree outside the window of room 238, Richard Negus's hotel room. A cut on the face of a smartly dressed man might stand out and invite questions, no? One who is careful about his appearance would surely not allow a razor to make an unsightly mark upon his face. Mr. Kidd did not want me to think along these lines. He did not want me to wonder if he might recently have climbed out of an open window and down a tree. So he created the general unkempt appearance. He arranged himself to look like the sort of man who would be so careless as to cut himself while shaving, and then, to avoid further cuts, walk around with half a beard on and half off. Such a chaotic man would, of course, use his shaving razor recklessly and do damage. This is what Poirot was supposed to believe, and it is what he did believe at first.
"Hold on a minute, Poirot," I said.
"If you're saying that Samuel Kidd climbed out of Richard Negus's hotel room window, am I saying that he murdered Mr. Negus?" "No, he did not. He assisted the murder of Richard Negus. As for who that person is, I have not yet told you the name."
Poirot smiled. "No, you haven't," I said sharply. "Nor have you told me who were the three people in room 317 when Raphael Bobach took up the afternoon tea. You said that the three murder victims were all dead by then."
"Indeed they were. One of the three in room 317 at 7:15 was Ida Gronsberry, dead, but positioned upright in a chair to appear alive as long as one did not see her face. Another was Samuel Kidd, playing the part of Richard Negus."
"Yes, I see that, but who was the third?" I asked rather desperately. "Who was the woman posing as Harriet Sipple, gossiping with spiteful glee? It can't have been Jenny Hobbs. As you say, Jenny would have had to be halfway to Pleasant's Coffee House by then."
"Ah, yes, sir. The woman gossiping gleefully," said Poirot. "I shall tell you who that was, my friend. That woman was Nancy Duquesne."
Loud cries of shock filled the room.
"Oh, no, Monsieur Poirot," said Luca Lazzari. "Signora Duquesne is one of the country's foremost artistic talents. She is also a most loyal friend of this hotel. You must be mistaken."
"I am not mistaken, mon ami." I looked at Nancy Duquesne, who sat with an air of quiet resignation. She denied nothing that Poirot had said. Famous artist Nancy Duquesne conspiring with Samuel Kidd, Jenny Hobbs's former fiancé. I had never been more flummoxed in my life than I was at that moment. What could it all mean?
"Did I not tell you, Catchpole, that Madame Duquesne wears the scarf over her face today because she does not wish to be recognized? You assumed that I meant recognized as the celebrated portrait painter. No, she did not want to be recognized by Raphael Bobek as the Harriet he saw in room 317 on the night of the murders. Please stand and remove your scarf, Mrs. Duquesne."
Nancy did so.
"Mr. Bobek, was this the woman you saw?"
"Yes, Mr. Poirot, it was."
It was quiet, but audible nonetheless, the sound of breath being drawn into lungs and held there. It filled the large room.
"You did not recognize her as the famous portrait painter, Nancy Duquesne?"
"No, sir. I know nothing about art, and I only saw her in profile.
she had her head turned away from me.
I am sure she did.
In case you happen to be an art enthusiast and able to identify her.
I spotted her as soon as she walked in today, though. Her and that Mr. Kid chappy. I tried to tell you, sir, but you wouldn't let me speak.
Yes, and so did Thomas Brignell try to tell me that he recognized Samuel Kid, said Poirot.
Two of the three people I thought were murdered, alive and well, walking into the room.
From his voice, it was evident that Raphael Bobak had not yet recovered from the shock.
What about Nancy Duquesne's alibi from Lord and Lady Wallace? I asked Poirot.
I'm afraid that wasn't true,
said Nancy.
It is my fault. Please do not blame them. They are dear friends and were trying to help me. Neither St. John nor Louisa knew that I was at the Bloxham Hotel on the night of the murders. I swore to them that I had not been, and they trusted me. They are good, brave people who did not want to see me framed for three murders I did not commit. Monsieur Poirot, I believe you understand everything, so you must know that I have murdered nobody.
To lie to the police in a murder investigation is not brave, madame. It is inexcusable. By the time I left your house, Lady Wallace, I knew you to be a liar.
How dare you speak to my wife like that? Said St. John Wallace.
I am sorry if the truth is not to your taste, Lord Wallace.
How did you know, Monsieur Poirot?
His wife asked.
You had a new servant girl, Dorcas. She is here with you today, only because I asked you to bring her. She is important to this story. You told me that Dorcas had been with you for just a few days, and I saw for myself that she is a little clumsy. She brought me a cup of coffee and spilled most of it. Luckily, not all was spilled, and so I was able to drink some. I immediately recognized it as the coffee made by Pleasant's Coffee House. Their coffee is unmistakable. There is no other like it anywhere.
Blimey, said Fee Spring.
Indeed, mademoiselle. The effect upon my mind was profound. At once, I put together several things like pieces of a jigsaw that fit perfectly. The strong coffee, it is very good for the brain.
Poirot looked pointedly at Fee as he said this. She pursed her lips in disapproval.
This not very capable maid, pardon me, Mademoiselle Dorcas, I'm sure you will improve given time. She was new. I put this fact together with the coffee from Pleasance, and it gave me an idea. What if Jenny Hobbs was Louisa Wallace's maid before Dorcas? I knew from the waitresses at Pleasance that Jenny used to go there often to collect things for her employer, who was a posh society lady. Jenny spoke of her as her ladyship. It would be interesting, would it not, if Jenny, until a few days ago, worked for the woman providing Nancy Duquesne's alibi. An extraordinary coincidence, or not a coincidence at all. At first, my thoughts on this matter proceeded along an incorrect track. I thought, Nancy Duquesne and Louisa Wallace are friends who have conspired to kill la pauvre Jenny.
What a suggestion, said Louisa Wallace indignantly.
A shocking lie,
her husband St. John agreed.
Not a lie, pas du tout. A mistake. Jenny, as we see, is not dead. However, I was not mistaken to believe that she was a servant in the home of St. John and Louisa Wallace, replaced very recently by Mademoiselle Dorcas. After speaking to me at Pleasance on the night of the murders, Jenny had to leave the Wallace's house, and quickly. She knew
that I would soon arrive there to ask for confirmation of Nancy Duquesne's alibi. If I had found her there working for the woman providing that alibi, I would instantly have been suspicious. Catchpole, tell me, tell us all, what exactly would I have suspected? I took a